Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining today's Financial Planning for a Future with MS. Your host for today is Rose Taylor. Ms. Taylor, you may begin.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Rose Taylor, and I'm the Vice President of Programs for the Michigan Chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. On behalf of the Society, I would like to welcome you to tonight's final program of the Midwest Teleconference Series titled Financial Planning for a Future with MS. This program is brought to you through a collaboration of the National MS Society's Midwest Region Chapters. Together, we provide programs, services, and research to improve the lives of people affected by MS. Recordings of this call will be available to each chapter for anyone wishing to refresh their notes or share with a friend. Our speaker provided a handout for tonight's call. You will notice that the title of the handout is Lifetime Planning and Estate Planning Overview of Issues. If you did not receive the handout in advance, please do not hesitate to contact your local chapter office to receive a copy. We'd also like to mention that there is a wealth of information made available by the Society through your local chapter for all levels of participation. We encourage you to reach out to your local chapter by calling 800-344-4867 or by visiting their website for a list of upcoming events and programs. Tonight's program is supported by an educational grant from Genzyme. Please note that during the first part of the program, during our speaker's presentation, you will be in listen mode. Feel free to jot down your questions and your concerns as you listen. Following the presentation, the operator will open the lines for anyone to ask questions. We ask that all participants with questions to limit their time to one question per request so that as many participants as possible may enjoy a direct response to from our speaker. Tonight, we are fortunate to have as our speaker David A. Mawson. David is an attorney who focuses his practice on estate planning and business succession planning for owners of privately owned companies. Mr. Mawson is a regular presenter to many different organizations as well as educational institutions on a variety of topics, including estate planning. Mr. Mawson is also a contributing author to the Michigan Institute of Continuing Legal Education, a member of the State of Michigan Bar Association Estate Planning, Corporate and Taxation Sections, and is a partner in the law firm of Barnes and Thornburg, a full-service law firm with over 550 attorneys located throughout the country. And now, I'd like to welcome David Mawson to begin this evening's program. David?
Rose, thank you very much for that introduction. First of all, I would like to say to everyone that's on the line tonight, it's a real pleasure to be here with you this evening. I have a personal vested interest in presenting to this group. My mother and my aunt both have multiple sclerosis, and we've lived with this disease for a number of years as a family, and my aunt and my mother continue to battle this disease, and we hope that we can continue to move forward and find ways to deal with this disease for all of us and our loved ones. The topic tonight, lifetime planning and estate planning, let me begin by stating that many people think of estate planning as writing a will, dealing with a situation that would involve their death. And although that is a component of the estate plan process, it's only one. There are a number of lifetime planning decisions that need to be thought through, discussed with your loved ones, and then reduced to a written plan so that if something happens to us, whether that be a stroke, whether that be a situation of being incapacitated through MS or some other disease or life event, that we have a plan in place so that we can make sure that not only we have our daily living needs and financial needs taken care of, but we've also planned for our family members, that whether that be a spouse, children, or other family members that live with us. Through the course of the evening, I'm going to be referring to various slides that you may have access to, and I will give you a description of the slide that we will be moving to, and then covering some of the material that is on the slide itself, and then additional information that I did not include in the slide. Towards the end of this presentation, I'm going to focus on maybe four or five primary takeaways that I would ask for all of you to think about in terms of planning your own lifetime and estate plan, and then actually moving forward and contacting someone that you may know already, and if you don't have someone, finding someone that you can work with that can help you put this plan in writing. So let's go to our first slide, the first slide titled Introduction. All right, let's look at some of the points here. And I'll read some of these things and I'll paraphrase some of these things. But for those of you who don't have access to the slides at this point, slide one says, estate planning involves planning for many contingencies, including, and the first contingency is, should you become incapacitated, who will manage money and who will manage assets for you and your family? Who will make healthcare decisions for you? And there's many types of incapacity. It could be something that could be physically limiting your ability to make these decisions and handle your affairs. It could be mentally, something cognitive that impacts your ability to make these decisions. And there are different types of documents that you use to establish who will manage your business affairs, banking affairs, finances, bill payment. And then secondarily, but equally important, who will make healthcare decisions for you if you're not in a position to do so? So those are broad brush examples of lifetime planning decisions that need to be thought about and implemented. Now, secondarily, when you die, many different things that need to be considered, but for those of you who may have children under the age of 18, who will become guardians of your children? Another thing, who will manage money and assets for your children if something happens that you're gone and perhaps your spouse is gone? Who will step in? Who will manage that money until the children are a sufficient age to be able to take care of any money that they might inherit? There are basic building blocks that we use to put in to plan for an estate plan. And the way we typically review those building blocks is sitting down in an initial meeting between you and your attorney and discussing goals that you would have for your family or for you as an individual. And by the way, when I say family, when I say individual, I've done planning for individual single people, people who are married without children, people married with minor children, adult children, people who have long-standing living arrangements together. I mean, many different life circumstances. One thing everyone has in common is to plan for what happens to them during their lifetime, whether that be a car accident, a stroke, or something, for example, that results from MS, and then what happens after their passing. So the four basic building blocks, if you will, a will, a revocable living trust agreement, a durable power of attorney, and a healthcare patient advocate designation, which many people refer to as a medical power of attorney. These are the four basic building blocks. Now, let's assume that you do not have any of these documents, or perhaps you have just a will or just a power of attorney. If something happens to you during your lifetime, whether that be a stroke, the automobile accident, or some incapacity through MS, and you want to have someone designated to take care of your financial affairs, if you've not created these documents in advance, then you must resort to typically, in most states, a probate proceeding where you actually initiate a court proceeding and attorneys get together with the judge and make a determination as to who should be appointed to manage your affairs. Now, for a married couple, typically that's the spouse that does not have the incapacity. But for a single person, who might that be? I mean, it may be that they prefer to have a friend versus a family member. And it may be that they have a family member that they're comfortable with now, but 5-10 years from now, they may not be, given age of that person. So those are examples of why we would actually put written documents into place. If you pass away without written documents, then you're deemed to have died intestate, meaning you don't have a written estate plan. Now, what happens in a situation like that? Well, then we resort to state court law, depending upon what state you reside in. And although there are very similar rules from state to state, each state has differences and nuances as to how they handle who gets your estate. If you're married, it may be that your surviving spouse gets some but not all of your estate, particularly if you have minor children. But the point is, you don't get to plan how your estate will be divided. The state that you reside in will have default rules, which are in the state statute, that will tell your heirs how your estate will be divided. So for those reasons, along with many other reasons, including tax reasons, both estate and gift tax, which are based upon federal law as well as state law, there are many reasons why you would sit down with an attorney and other advisors and prepare a written estate plan. So at this point, let's move to the next slide, and the title of it is Current Overview of Estate and Gift Tax Rules, Including Federal Planning Issues. Now, for those of you who watch a lot of the cable television networks, that's something that I enjoy. I like watching all of them, whether it be Fox News, CNN, it doesn't matter. I enjoy watching these programs. 2 years ago, you may recall, at the tail end of 2012, there was a lot of discussion and a lot of news that revolved around what our income tax structure would be, what the new income tax brackets and rates would be. But at the same time, estate taxes and gift taxes were also part of the discussion. At the end of 2012, had Congress not acted, we were going to revert to rules that had been in place about 10 years earlier, in 2002. And the amount of assets that an individual person would be able to protect and pass along to surviving family members was $1 million. Many years ago, and I've been in practice for about 30 years at this point, but that number has been much lower than that. But in 2002, Congress was attempting to stimulate the economy, passed legislation that increased the amount of assets that could be passed to from one generation to the next over a 10-year period, so that the number went from $600,000 up to $3.5 million, and that was the last number at the end of 2012. That number of $3.5 million was set to drop back to $1 million because the 2002 act that included the increases was what was called a sunset law. Well, Congress got together, hammered out a new deal, and part of the new deal was they were going to implement permanent estate planning allowances that were more significant than what we had previously had. They set the new limit at $5 million per person, and if you were married, you could double that, $10 million. The old rules were going to be $1 million, and if you were married, $2 million. Now, this is a little bit simplistic, but the gist of what I'm covering at this point is this. Although we have permanent planning rules that are in place right now that are much more liberal in terms of what we can pass from one generation to the next, and although for 99.5% of all of us will never see this kind of asset base that we have to worry about protecting from estate taxes, it's very possible that a future Congress will, again, implement new rules and drop the numbers back down. In fact, some of the proposed legislation that I've seen for the next 2 or 3 years is indicating that there's a significant number of legislators that would like to move that number back down, something in the range of $1.5 million to maybe $2 million, maybe less. And again, big number, but this includes everything that you have at your death, the value of life insurance policies, the value of retirement assets, the equity in your home, if you own a business, the equity value of your business interest. So significant number, something to think about for many people. All right, let's go now to the next slide, which is slide 4. So what really are the planning rules? We're going to cover these fairly quickly, and then we'll get into actual planning documents and how we use the planning documents. But here are the key rules. So 2013, last year, the number was $5,250,000, not $5 million, because there's an inflation adjustment that we have now. In 2014, the current amount that you can pass, not have any estate tax, is $5,340,000. So we have an inflation adjustment, which is automatic, something that we had never had in the past. Now, here's the thing that as someone that spends a lot of time in the estate tax world, just makes me very frustrated, but it's the reality. The top estate tax bracket in 2013 is 40%, and that's what we have this year as well. So what that means is all the money that you set aside to protect for your retirement, to protect for your family, all that money, the majority of which you put aside in after-tax dollars, you hopefully earn a good rate of return and you beat inflation, but at your death, you have to worry about another layer of tax, estate taxes. And it's a graduated estate tax rate system, just like income taxes. The more you make under the income tax regime, the more you pay in tax. The more you have in the estate tax regime, the more you pay in estate tax. There's two ways you can move your estate, though, and do so without paying estate tax or gift tax. One is to use the lifetime allowance, which is $5,340,000 in 2014. Let's just say that you had $500,000 that you really didn't need, and you wanted to give away to someone, you could actually do that and not pay any estate or gift tax on it. But your allowance of $5.3 million would be dropped down by the $500,000. What would you be left with? $4.8 million in round numbers. In addition, you have an annual gifting allowance, so you can make gifts of $14,000 per year, per person, or donee. So let's assume Grandma and Grandpa are our clients, and they have three children, and they collectively have eight grandchildren. They could give, if they wanted, $14,000 per year per child, per spouse of their children, and even per grandchild. So the limit is how much you give to the individual person. But Grandma can give $14,000 to little Tommy, as can Grandpa, for a total of $28,000. It's a nice way, if you don't need the money, to spend down your assets, and you're not getting into your lifetime allowance. A couple of other basic things, and then we'll move on to the next slide. When you pass away, the value of your assets are valued as of your date of death or an alternative date that you can select approximately 6 months after the date of your death. The reason we do this, if your spouse needs to sell or your children need to sell assets to meet estate taxes, gift taxes, living expenses, things like that, they do not take over the basis that you would have in the asset. So if the marital home initially cost $25,000 and the marital home now costs $200,000, the beneficiaries of that marital home will get a step up in basis to the $200,000 mark. So if they turn around and sell it, they will not have any capital gains. The reason I bring that up, if you give something away during your lifetime, the gifted asset doesn't get a step up in basis. The gifted asset goes to the donee, the person receiving the gift, but they take over the basis that the giftor, the person who made the gift, had. So in this case, if that house was gifted, the basis would be $25,000. And if the same beneficiary sold the house, they'd have capital gains on $175,000. All of these things are things that need to be thought about when you discuss the various planning goals that each of you will have as clients of an estate planning attorney, or even maybe doing documents if you try on your own. But you need to be aware of the fact that there are many times multiple options, multiple directions you can go with planning an estate, but there are pros and cons of each option. And there's no right or wrong answer. It's what fits your particular family, what fits your particular planning goals. So again, proper process would be you meet with an authorized, reputable, experienced estate planning attorney and other advisors and discuss your goals. And then it's the job of the advisors to analyze the options available to you legally to plan your estate and then give you the advice and the pros and cons so you can make an educated decision. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So we're on slide number 5, and the title of it is wills. A will, that's the basic document that you would put together to divide your estate among your heirs if you don't have a trust that goes along with the will, and to take care of other events that need to be dealt with at your death. Now remember, we talked about at the beginning of this talk, there's lifetime planning decisions and there's death planning decisions. A will only deals with death planning decisions. There are no lifetime planning decisions that are made in a will. What are the types of decisions? What are the types of things that you use a will to do? Well, number one, if you've got minor children, you can name guardians in the will. Who would be legally responsible to raise your children, take care of your children, if you and your spouse were no longer living? Secondarily, you can use a will to divide your estate, your assets, and say, I want these assets to go to my surviving spouse, I want these assets to go to my children, or these assets to go to my surviving spouse, and if something happens to him or her, to drop to my children. I'd like to make gifts to the following charitable organizations. I have a gift to a family member or a friend that I would like to make. And so you actually use the will to put in writing what you want to have happen with the assets that are just in your name at your death. Now we're going to get into the use of trusts at a later point. There's different types of trusts, but the key thing that I'd like to stress here is a will deals with transferring ownership of assets that are in your name only. Now, what are some exceptions to that? One exception would be this: assets that are jointly owned. Husband and wife own the marital home jointly. Husband passes away first, wife takes the home in full because wife was a joint owner. Let's contrast that. Let's say the husband and his brother own a piece of property. Maybe it's a cottage, a family cottage. Maybe it was an investment piece of property. And they own that property as tenants in common. Husband and wife, the typical form of ownership is tenancy by the entireties, meaning you both own 100% at the same time, essentially, because of your marriage union. But in this situation, you have a husband, the husband of the family, the client, and brother, and they own the property jointly. But what they own is an undivided 50% interest. Well, in the will, you can specify, with regard to the husband's 50% interest in the property, who will take that upon the husband's death. And then the brother is now, in effect, for lack of a better way to describe it, a partner with regard to ownership with whoever the husband names. So that's tenants in common. So here's another building block. As you work through an estate plan and you work through how you own your assets currently, other areas of law need to be evaluated. So here we're looking at real property law. Okay. The other thing that you typically put in the will is that at your death, you want your bills to be paid, your medical bills, funeral bill, all the typical things that you would want, type of funeral service, that kind of a thing. Now, what do you do with the will when somebody passes away? Well, the will has to be submitted to a probate court, and there's a process to move that will through the probate court, and it can take different paths. Most states have a couple of different paths. One is more formal, where a judge is involved and basically reviews and approves each action taken to administer the will. There's another form called informal probate, which the judge takes a lesser role in, and the personal representative, we used to call this person the executor, does more of the work to administer the will. Wills going through a probate process, it's normally a 9 to 15 month period for a will to be probated. Now, for some families that's fine, for other families that may or may not be fine. If the majority of the assets are in the person's name who passed away, and the surviving spouse is not a joint owner of that assets or those assets, or is not a contractual recipient. For example, life insurance policy naming him or her, the surviving spouse, as the beneficiary of the life insurance policy, or retirement account naming the surviving spouse as the beneficiary. If there are beneficiary designations, the assets typically pass by contract fairly quickly, typically within 30 to 45 days at the outside. But an asset that moves through probate, for example, maybe the marital home was only owned by the husband and not the wife. To get that asset moved over, you have to actually get the approval, if it's a formal probate approval proceeding, of the judge to move the asset over to the wife. And if it's informal, there's other paperwork that has to be filed. But start to finish, an average probate proceeding runs 9 to 15 months. And it can also be expensive, because the more that a lawyer and other advisors have to move the will and administer the will and track down all the assets owned by the person who passes, the more expense there is to the probate process. So typically, as it says in this outline, you can spend 1 to 5% of the value of the estate in a probate proceeding. The larger the estate, the percentage drops, obviously, but typically probate's more expensive than doing the planning work up front, and typically probate is a much longer process to get the assets to the surviving spouse and children. One other interesting thing, the probate process is public, and so for some people they're very concerned that neighbors, family members will know what they had in terms of assets, who their estate goes to. If you administer a will through probate, that's public record. If you use the trust proceeding route, as we'll discuss in a couple of slides, that's private. All right, let's go to the next slide, which is the continuation of the previous slide on wills. Another interesting thing to think about, if something happens to both husband and wife, assets which pass to minor children, even if you have a will, but you don't have trust, the assets become the children's assets at the age of 18. And I've worked with clients who've said, that's fine, age 18 is fine. And I've had others say, no, I'd rather the children not have full access to the funds until they're 25 or 30 or older. Or maybe they give some of the money at 25, some of the money at 30, some at 35. In addition, with divorce proceedings involving a child, if a child has assets in their name, then that asset becomes a marital asset for their marriage situation if they get divorced. So they inherit money prior to the age of 18. They get married when they're 22. And at 25, they're getting divorced. If they got $250,000 in inheritance from their parents, that $250,000 becomes a marital asset. Alternatively, if that money had been held in trust, it would not necessarily become a marital asset, and in many cases, it wouldn't be. Plus, you can establish a trusted family member or friend who you would typically select to be like a contingent trustee to help manage that money on behalf of your children until they get to an age that you feel comfortable that they can manage it. All right, so the last bullet point on this slide talks about the planning and the amount of planning you can do if you're married. I mean, these numbers are very, very big. I like to talk about this with clients. I would focus less on the tax implications. For many people, it's just not an issue. But what you want to think about is, if something happened to you in a life event, would you want to have everything properly organized before you had the life-altering event, whether that be a stroke, the car accident, or becoming incapacitated by some aspect of your MS? And if you want to have things organized in advance, then using a revocable living trust agreement, which will be our next discussion, is something you should consider doing. Okay. We're now on the slide. It's slide number 7, revocable living trusts. Now, I think I mentioned earlier there's different types of trusts. There's testamentary trusts. There's revocable living trusts, and there's probably a dozen more types, but those are the two that are most common for most families in planning. What's a testamentary trust? A trust that is testamentary comes into existence at your death. So in your will, you would say, I don't want my children to have access to the assets if they're under the age of 18, so if I pass away and my children are under the age of 18, I'd like to have a trust, and I'd like my brother-in-law, for example, to manage our assets until my children are at the age of 25. That's a testamentary trust. It comes into existence on the date of your death. Alternatively, what I'm describing here is called a revocable living trust. You make it while you're living. Every aspect of it, every decision that you make in the trust is revocable. You can change your mind. There are trusts that are called irrevocable trusts. And once you make them, you can't change anything in them. Those are used typically for people that have more than what they can protect from the $10.6 million current allowance from estate taxes, and that's another strategy we would employ. But a revocable living trust, the key things are you make it during your lifetime, and you can change the terms. You run this trust just like you would run the assets if you own the assets in your own name or jointly with your spouse. Any income generated on an investment account, for example, is still flowed through to your personal income tax return and reported under your Social Security number. So for taxation purposes, for income tax, it's not treated any differently. What's the benefit? What's the benefit of setting this type of trust up in advance? Well, for one thing, you get to pick who will be your trustee and who will manage things if something happens to you. So for many people, it would be their surviving spouse. But maybe it would be their surviving spouse and their brother, or their surviving spouse and a private trust company. There are many different types of selections that people make, but the key point is you're selecting in advance who will manage your affairs. Otherwise, a court will have to schedule a hearing, and there will have to be a determination made by a judge as to who will manage your affairs. That could be your spouse, and it might not be. I mean, there are professional individuals who will be appointed by the court to manage people's financial and business affairs, and that may or may not be something that you would have liked to have seen happen with your estate, particularly if you're living. Think about this. Your incapacity could be permanent, but it also may be temporary. What if it's a 9-month incapacity and you get better? Or what if it is a permanent incapacity? In either case, you probably would prefer to have somebody that you select manage your affairs. Now, once you set this type of trust up, and the way you do so is you talk with the attorney and you discuss the kinds of things that are important to you. I would like to have the assets used for my health and my support, for my wife's, if it's a husband, you know, establishing it, for my wife's health and support, and if they have children, for my children's health and support, and education, perhaps. You can indicate virtually any kind of term or limitation that you want to have that's important. I've had situations where I've had clients say to me that they have children. Each child's got a particular strength and a particular weakness, and so therefore they'd like to have each child's trust share managed a little bit differently. I mean, the key thing is to think about what types of life events apply to your family, and what would you like to see done to address those, okay? So let's now talk about the second paragraph here before we go to the next slide. How do you use a trust? Once you establish it, you need to move assets into it. So think about a trust as a basket. Construct the basket. The basket doesn't do you any good if you don't put things inside the basket. Well, how do you put an asset inside the trust? Let's say it's an investment account, and the investment account is with Smith Mutual Fund. Instead of the investment account being owned by the individual husband or jointly by the individual husband and wife, you would title that asset as owned by husband's trust or wife's trust, or 50% by husband's trust, 50% by wife's trust. And why do you do that? Well, you want that asset to be moved into the trust before you have your triggering event that makes you incapacitated. Why? Because everything's set up. The trustee can come in and immediately start managing assets as opposed to after the fact, collecting assets, trying to get access to use the assets. So everything is set up in advance. Assets you move into this type of trust can be moved out at any time, now in the future, and it's no adverse tax effects. There's no adverse income, estate, gift, or capital gains effect. You just report any income as you would on your personal income tax return. A couple of other points. Let's go to the next slide. Revocable living trust continued. Although trusts can be used to help reduce estate taxes, the primary reason we use these trusts is to make sure that the trustee has access to these trusts immediately so that during lifetime, they can be used immediately for your benefit, your spouse, and your children. But God forbid, if something happens to you and you pass away, the assets are also available to be managed by the trustee again for surviving spouse, surviving children. And you're the one, in advance, has set the plan. In other words, your state where you reside didn't tell you and your heirs how your estate is to be managed. And in many cases, the percentage of who gets what may be markedly different based upon the state statute versus what you would select. One other ancillary thing that's kind of interesting, there is some liability protection that's also afforded by putting assets into trust ahead of time. God forbid if there was an automobile accident or something that triggered a liability claim against you. If your assets are already in trust and the beneficiary of your assets are your spouse and children, under most state laws, there's liability protection that's similar to what would be at a corporate level or a limited liability company level, the trust. Those assets were set aside before any claims were known or mature, and they were set aside to take care of your family members. Now, there's some exceptions to that, but it's kind of an ancillary point that most people were surprised to find out exists, but they kind of like once they realize that. All right, let's go to the next slide, durable powers of attorney. This is slide number 9. A durable power of attorney is typically used to delegate the authority to handle your finances, your bill payment, your banking, deposit of checks, payment of bills, all sorts of things, right? If you're not able to do it. Now, in the second paragraph of the slide, it says the term durable means the document can be used to allow the representative to make decisions when the person becomes incapacitated. So let's say husband nominates wife to be power of attorney if husband cannot serve. husband becomes temporarily unable to handle his affairs. So the power of attorney can be used by the wife to take care of the business affairs of the husband. If the husband becomes permanently disabled, that incapacity does not affect the power of attorney. It becomes permanent, and the wife can continue to take care of the affairs. One other interesting thing, I've had people try to use powers of attorney after a person passes away. You cannot use a power of attorney after a person passes away. Its only function is to be the grant of authority when a person is living, but they are not able to manage their affairs. What if the person passes away? Who's going to manage their affairs? Well, if you only have a will, you're going to go by way of the will. If you have a trust, it'll be the trustee managing things. If you don't have a will or a trust, you're back to having the court help manage things and get things transferred over to the surviving spouse. So each one of these four basic building blocks of documents, wills, revocable trusts, durable powers of attorney, and we're going to get to the next one here in a moment, healthcare powers of attorney, let's go to the next one, healthcare patient advocate designations. A healthcare patient advocate designation is also commonly referred to as a living will or a medical power of attorney. Now, what this document is used for is this. The person who makes it is saying, if I cannot make a medical decision on my behalf, then I designate this person to make decisions for me. Now, this is a little different than the business power of attorney. A medical power of attorney is only going to be invoked, again, if you can't make a decision, and there are very precise limits as to what your advocate can and cannot do. Under most states' statutes, which are very similar, the person who's called the patient advocate, the person who would make the medical decisions for the disabled person, their authority will come expressly from that medical power of attorney. So if it says, I grant full discretion to my advocate to make all decisions after weighing pros and cons offered by the treating physician, then that person has full authority. It can also be drafted in such a way that it says, I give authority to this person to make all decisions. However, here are some things that I want to carve out that I just don't want no matter what. For example, I don't want to be hooked up to any kind of an artificial life support means, a ventilator. But then consider this. What if the ventilator is something that helps you on a temporary basis, and then you can get off the ventilator and you can get back to a quality of life? So you have to be very, very careful. You draft these to express exactly what you do and do not want. Hospitals and doctors are very concerned that they're not interpreting these things as precisely or as intended by the person who made it out. So they're going to be very, very seriously and carefully scrutinized by healthcare providers. So you want to be very clear how you draft this, and you want to be very clear in your instructions to the person who helps you draft. And by the way, if you're under a condition where you cannot make a healthcare decision, whether it be medication or the physical condition that you're in, and you're later in a position where you can get back and make your own decisions, you've not given away that authority forever. You're back in control of your own life. A couple of other quick slides we'll go through here, and then we'll get close to the point where we're going to do questions. But slide number 11 is called Common Myths and Misunderstandings About Estate Planning. I've only put two of these down, but these are two that I encounter many, many times. One, I'll have people that say, well, I own all my assets jointly, so I'm going to avoid probate, right? And the answer to that is you might avoid a lot of the probate process, but you're not going to avoid it completely. But more importantly, that doesn't help you with the lifetime planning decisions. And what if something happens to both you and your spouse where you're both incapacitated, but you're still both living? So That will help you if there's a death situation, and that will help you if the majority of your assets are owned jointly, but it doesn't address a lot of the things that we've talked about tonight. The second thing is, I don't have that much, so therefore I don't need to make an estate. What people don't realize is everything that they own, including the death benefit of a life insurance policy, if you have a term life insurance policy of $1 million, that $1 million is added into your basket to determine whether you are over that $5.3 million allowance. Your retirement money is included, your home equity, your business equity. You can deduct the value of mortgages on real estate, business debt, things like that, and you look at the net position. But if this number that you can protect from estate taxes drops back to something in the range of $2 to $2.5 million, $1 to $1.5 million, it's very possible. This will be more pertinent for most people. All right, last slide before questions. Key lifetime planning decisions. A couple of points I wanted to add. Under the power of attorney discussion we had just a few moments ago, you can have two types of power of attorney. You have a full power of attorney or limited power of attorney. I've had people say, you know what, I'm going to be selling a piece of property. I'd like somebody to go to the closing, handle it for me, but I don't want to give them power of attorney over everything that I own or over every decision I can make. I want to limit it to just this situation or similar situations. So that's the difference between a full power of attorney and a limited power of attorney. Just discussing powers of attorney would be beyond the scope of this presentation, but the point that I'd like to make is, again, if you articulate to the person who you'll be working with to help you draft your planning documents what your goals are, that person, he or she who is advising you, should be able to give you good advice as to what type of form you want to work with, whether it's full power of attorney, limited power of attorney, and similar issues. Another thing under the bullet point there, benefits of using a trustee. Really think it's important to have a family member or a friend involved. For one thing, they know you. They know your spouse. Hopefully, they know your children. Hopefully. But at the same time, you may be asking this person to do an extraordinary amount of work, keeping books and records, managing your affairs, preparing income tax returns. If it's something that is over a long period of time, so a lot of times I draft where I make two trustees work together in a co-trustee position, individual family member or friend, and a professional trust company to assist. And the added benefit of that is the professional trust company also will have liability insurance in case something's missed or, frankly, just the ball is dropped on something. Last point, for those of you in the audience who might own a business, what do you do about your business? If you have a good planning document in place, a succession plan for your business where you identify who's going to take the business over and run it, or you've got a strategic partner who will buy your business, or something that will give you an exit strategy, that's great. A lot of people worry about doing that when they're ready to do it as opposed to planning in advance. But the key thing is you have to integrate that business succession plan with your personal estate plan because, again, most business owners, the single business asset their biggest asset that they typically have is the equity in their company and maybe company real estate. So that's something to think about. So, Rose, at this point, if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to listen and answer.
Thank you, David. The operator is going to open the line for questions, but before she does, participants, please limit your questions to one per person. Operator?
Yes, ma'am. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number one key on your phone. Our first question is from Mary Ann. Go ahead. Mary Ann, your line is live. Please go ahead with your question. Okay, our first question is from Joanne. Joanne, go ahead. Hello, Joanne. Your line is live. Please go ahead with your question. Okay, we'll move to the next one. Our next question is from Don. Don, go ahead. I'm sorry. Our next question is from Deborah. Deborah, go ahead.
Yes. I mean, the numbers you're talking about in this are, to me, astronomical. I don't even have $100,000 income and assets combined, and for many of the programs having MS, you can't have any assets, basically. What would be the point to pay somebody to set up all these documents when it's money that I could be used to you to live now?
Well, Deborah, that's a good question. Let's start with this. For people that are on plans that are governmental assistance or similar types of plans, you are 100% right that in many states there are repayment obligations and there are limits as to the assets that you can hold. And then from a practical standpoint too, there are many people that are very much in your boat. The question I would ask you is this. If you did not factor in the cost, and then I'll get back to cost here in a moment, of preparing a plan, would it give you peace of mind to know that if something happened you couldn't actively manage your affairs, that somebody would be lined up in advance to help you with that? In other words, would you be interested in preparing the documents? And if so, here's the suggestion that I make. There are many, many very good attorneys that can prepare plans, and pricing can range quite a bit. It depends upon the experience of the attorney. It depends upon the level of detail that you put into a plan. But plans can be written for, and I'm talking about very, very basic plans, for $750 for wills and powers of attorney and healthcare powers of attorney, typically. And if you add a trust, you might spend another $500 to $750 to $1,000. It kind of depends on how much specific tailoring you would do. But that is a rough rule of thumb. And I've had clients spend much, much more in the event that they're protecting more money. But the key thing is, in a lot of states, there are not repayment terms. And so people are looking to maximize the amount of assets that are available for their own use during their lifetime. And then if something does happen and they pass, they want to maximize the amount of assets that they want to drop to their surviving spouse and children. I hope I've answered your question.
Our next question is from Tim. Tim, go ahead.
You were talking about gifting as much as $14,000 per person in a family situation or whatever. Is this have anything to do with the five-year look-back rule?
It's a very good question. In some states it might, Tim, and it depends upon what state you reside in. But for most states, if you have established a gifting pattern and you followed a gifting pattern, then typically that gifting pattern will be respected. Now, how do you prove that? Well, you go back and you say, look, I wrote checks for graduation from high school, graduation from college, birthday, and here's what I've done every year, and I didn't just start this year, assuming that I was spending down, if you will, because that's what you're referring to. Where I've seen people get into more of a situation is when they get into that lifetime gifting allowance and they start gifting large chunks of money and they've never made those gifts before. And typically the five-year look-back period is kind of a hard and fast rule in that situation. But again, each state's a little bit different in terms of repayment obligations, what the allowances are in terms of assets that you can keep. Some states allow an unlimited amount of equity in a home. Sometimes people make gifts of certain assets that would not be something that would be in that type of allowance, if you will. But it's a very good question.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is our final question. From Elaine, go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering about the capital gains taxes.
Yes.
Is there any way of knowing... I assume that, for instance, my mother passed away, willed the land to my brothers and I. And now a capital gains, they would take at what it was valued at the time of her death, and then if we sold, then we would pay according to that then? Is that correct?
Possibly. It depends upon, you know, where you're living. But under federal law, okay, so for your federal income tax return, if you took that asset and you received the ownership of it as a result of her death, is that what you're saying? I think it is. If you take it at her death, you get a step up in basis. So whatever the value is as of the date of her death, or typically 6 months after the date of her death, then you use that as your baseline, that's your basis, and then if you sell the property a year later and you sell it for, we'll just say, $10,000 more, then you would have gain on the $10,000. Some states, though, are allowing, Michigan, for example, is one, which is where I actually practice, are allowing families to transition real property that was in the family as a homestead, the family home, and dropping it to the next generation, the kids, and not having any need to sell it, or if it is sold, eliminating any capital gains in that situation on a state level. So it does depend upon what state you live in and what your legislation is. I would encourage you to talk to your tax preparer. But you know, I think if you consider the initial that you should get a full step up to basis as of the date of her death. But again, you know, consult your current advisors to be certain, because I don't, you know, given in a short conversation like this, it's very hard to know if we have all the details and cannot offer any advice that you can rely upon, given the nature of this type of proceeding. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, I guess that was the last question, David. So this concludes our program. Thank you, everyone on the line, for joining us. And thank you, David Molson, for presenting the topic of lifetime planning and estate planning this evening. Do you have anything else to say, David?
I don't, but again, thank you for inviting me, Rose. It's a real pleasure and truly an honor to speak to your organization and your members.
Thank you. Yay. Participants, please take time to respond to our program survey online, included in our program reminder email, and contact your chapter to receive the link. Also, be looking out for the announcement about the new nationwide teletraining program that will replace the Midwest teleconference series this fall. If you have any questions, please contact us at 800-344-4867. And again, thank you, David, for your presentation this evening. At this time, all participants are invited to remain on the line and give their responses to three short survey questions. I hope you all have a wonderful evening. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, this begins our polling session. Our first question is, I learned something new that I will use in my everyday life. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. Again, I learned something new that I will use in my everyday life. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. The poll for this question is now closed. Please hold while we prepare our next question. Second question. The content was presented clearly and in an unbiased way. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. Again, the content was presented clearly and in an unbiased way. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. The poll for this question is now closed. Please hold while we prepare our final question. Final question. The speaker was knowledgeable about the topic. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. Again, the speaker was knowledgeable about the topic. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the polling session. You may all disconnect.